Welcome to CT Expert Insights. When your business needs expert advice on compliance issues, you can count on us. We provide tips, tools, and strategies to help you at every stage of your business's life cycle.
Hi, I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest this week is Bill Moore, Senior Manager of Transactional Business Consultants and Law Firm Sales for CT Corporation. Today, we're going to be talking about the sometimes intimidating topic of secure transaction law, as well as due diligence on some of those key topics. Bill is here to help us understand the concepts a whole lot better. And Bill, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Businesses often use what are called uniform commercial code filings to protect themselves during significant transactions, but any mistakes can often have big consequences. So what are some tips for what's known as due diligence and ensuring your security interest?
Well, a lot can be done in the interest of due diligence. It's really important that secured lenders and counsels representing clients and banks take a strong search methodology and a strong due diligence path to uncover certain lien types that are pertinent to their deal or that can throw their deal or derail their deal. Some of the due diligence tips are related to searching in the right jurisdictions under the right legal name. It's very important to search the debtor name and to get it correct. It's important to also go to the right jurisdictions. Typically, counsel will search at the central filing office, which is the Secretary of State type office typically, and they'll look for certain types of liens. But often that'll include additional searches at the local and county level, and then looking for hidden liens that may impact their deal as well.
And if you find those things, how do you make sure that there is an additional risk as a result of that?
Well, it really depends on the size of the deal. It depends on the industry you're working in. So there might be certain reasons to take a deeper dive. There are liens out there like hospital liens or mechanics liens if you're dealing with a construction deal. There could be ERISA or Environmental Protection Agency, EPA liens that are part of, could be part of a transaction that could derail you as well. So finding all of those would have certain consequences. Most importantly is looking for other liens outside of just UCC Article 9, like federal and state tax liens and judgment liens. Those liens can actually trump a UCC financing statement. And when found, counsel needs to sort it out and deal with how much monies are involved, who is going to pay that off or remedy it, or make the hard decision to say if this is a financing deal, this particular debtor may not be funded.
When you talk about deep dives and making sure you know about all the liens that are out there, is there a fairly limited number of places that you will find these things and where they're filed, or could this be in a wide variety of places?
Well, generally, the code's done a good job at indicating where you need to file. And like I mentioned, there's a central filing office in each state, but also the county level, which liens are located, your UCC fixture filings and regular UCC liens, in addition to federal and state tax liens and judgment liens. But there's hundreds, if not, well, there's thousands of counties out there that can be searched. So understanding the code and why you need to search at that level is paramount. In addition to those lien types, I strongly recommend that a searcher, be it lender's counsel or any counsel, should also look for litigation, pending litigation. Basically, pending litigation is a judgment lien in waiting. So outside of lien law itself, there may be a case or cases out there where your debtor is actually a defendant. And if the court lays down a decree and say you owe X amount of money, that basically hasn't been walked across the street into the recorder's office as a judgment, yet would severely impact or could impact the solvency of a particular debtor who's in the deal. So then trying to understand, do I go to the federal courts or to the state courts? And if the state courts, which civil court is pertinent here? So really relying on strong service providers and competent counsel to navigate those waters is going to be paramount to the deal.
Do you have to also spend some time navigating the strength of the case against them? Or is it a pause button when you run into pending litigation? How do you evaluate that?
No, that's a great question. So really that goes back to counsel making a legal opinion. And typically what we would grab is a docket to tell you what's happening in the case, the complaint to say what they're asking for or what was breached. And then finally, if there's been a recent decree or some type of ruling, that too would be pulled. So all of that has to be reviewed. It could be a minimal amount of money. It may not affect the assets that are up in question or being secured at the time. But generally speaking, counsel's going to want to know about that because it could be severe in terms of ramifications, depending if the debtor is now a defendant and has lost that case.
We've talked a lot about due diligence and doing things the right way. Let's talk about what can happen if you don't. Talk a little bit about loss of priority and how courts, especially recently, have been dealing with that. What are some of the biggest takeaways that you've seen?
Yeah, there's been some interesting case law over the years. Most recently, there's been the GM case has been talked about a lot. And within that case, briefly, is an adversary proceeding where an unsecured creditor committee asked the courts to determine whether or not a $1.5 billion UCC lien was now not perfected, and should be part of the unsecured creditors bucket. An administrative agent for GM had the authority to file the termination statement and authorized it. Unfortunately, it was not their intent to file that lien. They were trying to terminate a syndicated lease agreement that GM had already paid off. Unfortunately, he authorized, or they authorized, the termination of a syndicated term loan for $1.5 billion. The case here centered around, even though the administrative agent didn't have the authority to file, didn't have the intent to file against that, the $1.5 billion lien had nothing to do with that particular deal, they still did it. And because they had the authority to do it, it held up in court. So you can imagine the loss of $1.5 billion across secured lenders rippled across the industry. The takeaway and the lesson here is pretty simple. You really need to have a sound methodology as to how you're going to create your termination filings, making sure you double and triple check the search results that come back when you're doing your due diligence. I highly discourage counsel to send a list of UCC1 financing statements to an outside third-party vendor or somebody else who may not have a vested interest and say, create the terminations and file. So really doing thorough review, double-checking, writing out those terminations or electronically filing them, and having some type of checks and balances in place to make sure you're not erroneously filing, because once you have the authority to, the intent may not matter. There's other cases, Greg, where centered around the debtor name, which seems to be the most important. There was a case out of Utah going back a few years, and other jurisdictions as well, that centered around the debtor name, where punctuation and spacing mattered within the name. If the name was C period, W period, space, mining, or whatever the name might be, if that is how it is listed on the organic documents, the formation documents, or the articles of incorporation, that's the name that should be lifted and put on the document. Because punctuation was missing and a spacing was out there, the court said when you searched for that document, using the search logic of that particular state, and the filing wasn't found, it's to your detriment, filer, that it wasn't found. Punctuation and spacing shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter in a lot of jurisdictions, but in a few states it did, and it still does. So coming down to really understanding the true legal name of the debtor is going to be very important. There's also, outside of registered entities, Greg, filing under an individual name. Certain states now can adopt either alternative A or an alternative B state. And really, within some of those alternatives, the crux is looking at the driver's license or a state ID to determine the true legal name. What we saw happening over time, and still sometimes today, unfortunately, people are filing under a formerly known as, or maybe a maiden name, or, for example, Bill for William, Maggie for Margaret, Bob for Robert. And people may interact daily and have checking accounts under certain names. But really, it comes back to understanding what's it say on the driver's license on the most current state ID and using that name specifically. Finally, a lesson there is, when in doubt, if you're not sure that it's William A. Moore III or Bill Moore or William Moore or William A. Moore, you can file against multiple debtor names. Adding those debtor names to an attachment is pretty cheap insurance for a filer. May cost you a couple extra dollars to put that attachment on the public record, but at least you can sleep at night knowing that if a searcher went and looked for that document to get notice of that type of deal, under any variation, they might find it.
Wow. Good to have some flexibility there, but obviously details matter greatly when we're talking about issues like this. So in our last couple of minutes, Bill, let's just get a scope of how the business community is doing on this front, as well as the lenders. How well do the businesses and lenders have a grasp on how to proceed in these situations? And maybe if you even have an example of how doing things right paid off, or doing it wrong has kind of blown up in folks' faces.
Yeah, the Model Act is pretty straightforward. The drafters of the code did a great job at saying, this is how you need to perfect your security interest when you're filing. The problem we see is that with so much happening in a major deal, and it could be a merger or acquisition or a syndicate loan or a mezzanine level funding deal, there's so many spokes in that wheel that oftentimes the simple filing itself is taken for granted, and it may be passed over to maybe a junior paralegal or someone who's not well-versed, and it's often overlooked without a strong checks and balance. Many big firms have learned their lessons, and they stay on top of the case law. So the takeaway is to not take this simplistic form for granted, because the courts are going to be very strict. They're saying, we've given you ample opportunity to get the debtor name right. There's ways to find that true legal name. The collateral description needs to be basically an indication of the collateral. But remember, the financing statement itself is basically a snapshot of the security agreement behind the scenes. So getting that debtor name correct, a good indication of the collateral, and making sure the debtor name information, I mean, secured party information on there will be very important. The communities today are concerned about some of the more trickier nuances. If you have, for example, you're filing against a trust or trustee under Article 9, there could be 13 variations on how to file against that trust or trustee. It might depend on whether it's a registered trust, who the trustees are, who the beneficiaries are, what the settlers are involved, what addresses are involved, and all of those combinations can add up to some complexities that you need to navigate. Service providers like ourselves, who do this day in and day out, work with big law firms, medium law firms, and lenders to make sure we navigate those waters for them and help them in some capacity. But generally, it's going to come back to the legal opinion of outside counsel or even inside counsel to get that right and not take the simplicity of the form for granted.
Well, Bill, I'm glad you also mentioned the fact that CT can provide valuable services. That's what you do and others in your business do to help folks navigate this, because there's a lot of business owners who are experts on a lot of different aspects of their business, but maybe not this. And so it's good to have outside help, certainly the legal aspect, as you mentioned, but also from professionals like you. So thank you very much for helping us understand it better as we had this discussion today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Bill Moore is Senior Manager of Transactional Business Consultants and Law Firm Sales for CT Corporation. I'm Greg Corumbus, and for more information on this topic, please call CT at 844-787-7782.
With 125 years of experience, CT is here to help you at every stage of the business lifecycle.